Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics, Iowa style, and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart in Flagstaff, Arizona, for this broadcast. And as always, my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland, is alongside through the magic of electronics. It is good to be with you again, Laura.
Yes, absolutely. Great to be here.
We are about 1,000 miles apart, but boy, we have plenty to talk about, including those city council and school board elections held across the state last week and the troubling new rise in coronavirus cases in Iowa. But first, let's start with the ongoing strike at the John Deere Company. And indeed, it is ongoing because striking United Auto Workers members rejected the Deere Company's second contract proposal last week. So the walkout continued for 10,000 Deere workers in Iowa and other states. Union members voted against the proposed deal by a 55% to 45% margin. Laura, this was surprising to a lot of people who thought that maybe this contract was good enough to get approved. What happened?
Well, the labor reporters I follow on Twitter really had no idea how this was going to go throughout the day on Tuesday. And it was interesting. There seemed to be a split in the different locals. So there are five John Deere facilities in Iowa. Iowa has the bulk of the John Deere workforce. And in Ottumwa and Davenport, the vast majority of people voted to accept this offer from the company. And in Ankeny, which is close to our listening area, it was almost split right down the middle, 51% yes, 49% no. But Waterloo and Dubuque overwhelmingly voted down this contract. And Waterloo is the largest facility that Deere has. So they opposed it by like a 2-to-1 margin. And so it's interesting. I don't know what explains exactly why some locals were so much more opposed. For the first contract offer that they rejected in October, it was across the board, about 90% refused and across the company. So it was interesting to me that there was a bit of a split last week. And as far as I know, the two sides are not back at the negotiating table. Deere put out a statement saying that was their last best offer. So not clear exactly what's going to happen going forward.
Right. Now, this contract that was rejected would have given workers a 10% almost immediate pay hike, plus a couple of 5% hikes in 2023 and 2025. It looked as if that it had a shot because it was a pretty good deal from the outside. A lot of folks thought that. But again, it went down. What does this say about the state of play between the union and Deere right now?
Well, the comments that I saw people posting from the workers who voted it down, they acknowledged that it was a pretty good offer. It was much better than the first one, in addition to about double the pay raise that the company offered in the first contract. The pension situation was better. They also offered to keep new hires on the pension. The previous contract offer would have said anyone hired after November 1st of this year would not be eligible for Deere's pension program at all. So, but they're holding out for more. They feel that they have a lot of leverage. There's a workforce shortage right now that they feel works in their favor. And they think that the company can share a little bit more wealth because it has, the profits have just gone through the roof during the pandemic. So it wasn't that people didn't think it was a good offer. It was just that the people who voted against it thought that if they hold out, they could do a little better. And Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register quoted someone who voted for the contract, and he was skeptical of that, saying, you know, they could hold out for several more months and maybe get a marginal improvement or maybe not. But in the meantime, they're on the strike pay, which is substantially less than what they would be getting if they were back at work. So he didn't feel that it was worth it to push for a slightly better deal if it meant that they were going to be on strike for significantly longer.
Right, because strike pay is about $270, $275 a week, and that's not nearly what the Deere workers were making on the line.
No, not at all. I mean, so, one thing that's not clear to me is what kind of inventory the company has, because they have a lot of orders that they need to fill. And I've seen conflicting reports. You know, some say that they have enough inventory to satisfy their orders for several months, and some say that it could be tight. So I think part of that was factoring into people's calculations that the company is going to need to make a better offer to get people back on the line, because they can't keep these lines running with salaried employees. I mean, that's just not realistic.
Right. There was also a report this weekend, though, that I found interesting, that Deere's competitors, whom you might think now have an advantage because Deere is not putting out nearly as much as they could be, but they're suffering from the same problem of being unable to get parts and materials because of the coronavirus-backed supply chain problems that have cropped up all across the country. So Deere's competitors may not be in as good a position as you might think they would be.
Oh, that's interesting, Ed, so that they can't capitalize on the situation. I mean, Deere is really strongly positioned in their market. So I think that that is one argument that the company might hold out for quite a long time and see if they could just grind the workers down. I mean, they did lose this vote by very much, as you said, 55%, 45%. You don't have to flip very many people to make that deal pass. So, but like I said, I have not heard that they're even back at the negotiating table. So I'm not sure when they're going to be back trying to hammer out a deal.
So I found it interesting that the two biggest locals, as you pointed out, Waterloo and Dubuque, overwhelmingly rejected this. Have you heard anything at all, any reporting that you've done about any management problems at those two particular plants that might have caused workers to be angrier than at the other plants?
I have not, and I really don't know. I don't know if it's more related to the management at those factories or if it's more related to the leadership of the locals. I did hear in the weeks before they went on strike, there were some reports that some people were claiming, in any case, that there was illegal activity, that one of the plant manager in Waterloo was going around making what some people interpreted as threats, that if they went on strike, that, you know, this or that bad thing would happen. And so there might, it might be that people in Waterloo were resentful over that. I do remember seeing those reports in the media in the first half of October.
And you know what Deere might be hoping for is that as this strike progresses, that individual workers begin to cave and start crossing the picket line, and that eventually the entire strike could collapse. That has happened in some industries in the past.
It has, but the last year strike lasted for a little more than 5 months. And boy, it's hard for me to imagine the UAW members crossing the line. There seems to be a very high degree of solidarity right now. And that would be a huge taboo to do that. I have heard of Deere that they might be trying to bring in workers from other parts of the country to try to cross the line. And that may be, but the people who've been working in these factories for a long time, that's just hard to imagine that they're going to walk past their colleagues and their fellow UAW members on the picket line.
Well, we will be following this, and whatever happens, you will hear it on Capital Week with Laura and myself. Another big story last week, elections all across the state of Iowa, city council elections, mayoral elections, and school board elections, probably more focus on school boards than in any recent election. So why don't we start with that? First off, there were a couple of school boards that turned over into conservative hands, as you know, in Ankeny and in Johnston. Let's talk about what happened there.
Well, there was quite a bit of outside spending in both of those races. And in Ankeny, there's a new Republican PAC that was just formed in Ankeny in August or September, and they raised quite a bit of money. They had an electronic billboard on a busy intersection, and they had a direct mailing that went out that was paid for by the Republican Party of Iowa. But apparently the money was raised locally through this PAC for that. And that seems to have been a successful strategy. The turnout was extremely high. Turnout generally was high in these elections. If people may remember that before 2019, Iowa had school board elections in September and then local city elections in November. And one of the election bills that Republicans passed in their trifecta combined those two elections. And the idea was to increase turnout. And it does seem to have increased turnout for these school board races, because you get a lot of people who ordinarily wouldn't show up for these, and vice versa, people who ordinarily might vote for school board but might not vote for city council. And now they're voting in both of those elections. So turnout was quite high, but turnout in Ankeny was especially high. And so I think that the direct mail and the advertising that they did, this was quite a lot of political party spending, which is unusual for nonpartisan elections. City and school board candidates are not on the ballot with a party affiliation, but we've seen increasingly in Iowa, and I think in other parts of the country too, that the parties are getting more active. So on the Democratic side in Iowa, I haven't seen as much spending, but certainly the local Democratic activists have been knocking doors and doing the kind of get out the vote activities for city council candidates and school board candidates that we never used to see party organizations. And then on the Republican side, like I said, there's been quite a bit of spending. There was a 1776 PAC that got involved in the Johnston elections that endorsed the candidates there, and that seems to have been successful. But And most of the large school districts in Iowa, including Ames, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, West Des Moines, Waukee, the candidates running on the conservative platform of anti-masks or stoking a lot of fear about critical race theory, those candidates overall were not very successful. So they only won one out of the three school board seats in Urbandale, one out of the three school board seats in Lynmar, which is in the suburbs of Cedar Rapids, but they really got shut out in a lot of school districts, Bettendorf, Sioux City. I mean, it was, I would say overall, it was not a very successful election for that faction in those school board races.
Right.
With the exception of Anthony Johnson.
Those were the centers of the school mask debate, and the three winning candidates in Ankeny said they wanted to reverse the district's mask mandate, and in Johnston, the same thing. So I think those mandates are probably history in those school districts, but in Ankeny, it was particularly vigorous because the crowd got angry, and there was cursing and yelling at school board members. That was a rough one in Ankeny.
Yes, and as I mentioned, the turnout was very high. I mean, the candidates, the school board incumbents who had voted for the mask mandate, you can't say that they did badly. They got more votes than they had received in 2017 by a lot, but they just didn't get enough to overcome this turnout surge. And so I think that direct mailing and the billboard, I think that was successful. We just haven't seen that kind of campaigning in a school board race before it was a campaign style that we usually see in state legislative races, not in these nonpartisan city and school board elections. But I think we'll probably see it more because it seems to have been successful. But as I mentioned, in some of the other large school districts like Waukee and West Des Moines, not successful at all. And in Urbandale, that contingent only won one out of the three school board seats. So it's really hard to say I don't think that overall there was a trend, there was a reaction against schools and masks. The critical race theory doesn't seem to have been particularly successful there. It was in isolated communities, but overall statewide, at least in the larger school districts, it doesn't seem to have been very successful.
And we should not let this pass, this discussion about elections last week, without talking about what happened in Waterloo, because very quietly, at least quietly in central Iowa, because it's Waterloo in another part of the state, something happened to the city council that had never happened before in Iowa. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so Waterloo has had a black mayor, Quentin Hart, for some time. They only have 2-year terms for mayor. So he was on the ballot for the fourth time and won re-election by a pretty comfortable margin. But what was unusual there is they now have a black majority on the Waterloo City Council. There were three candidates running in different wards, and they all won their races, one of them narrowly, two by fairly large margins. And the race was a very major issue in the campaign because there was a new PAC that was created. I think we're going to see more PACs involved in local elections in Iowa. That seems to be a trend around the state. But a PAC was created this year that was called Cedar Valley Backs the Blue. They were very critical of the mayor, and they were critical of the chief of the Waterloo Police Department, who's also the first black police chief. And Ryan Foley of the Associated Press did some good reporting on, though, this police chief, Joel Fitzgerald, who told him Waterloo is the fourth city where he's been the first black police chief, and he's never experienced the kind of backlash that he's had in Waterloo. So there has been a contingent in the city, and including the people who were behind this new PAC, trying to say that the morale was terrible in the police department, and that bad things were happening, that the mayor was radical. And they used a classic racist trope that the mayor of Waterloo was trying to make the city like Chicago. You've probably heard when people in Iowa say they're coming in from Chicago or things like Chicago, that's often code language for race. And so it was exciting for the activists in Waterloo, the fact that this strategy was used. You couldn't even really call it a dog whistle because it was fairly blatant and it was not successful at all. So now they're going to have four black members on the city council, as well as the mayor being reelected by a pretty comfortable margin. And so the police chief's job is safe. And that is something that I think it makes quite a statement, because we did see we saw in the Virginia gubernatorial election and in other parts of the country that these campaigns against sort of a racial equity or whatever you want to call it. They call it critical race theory, but critical race theory isn't really part of what's going on. But this tactic against racial equity policies, police reform, that was not successful in Waterloo at all.
We should mention very quickly that in Ames, Anita Rollins became the first Black woman ever elected to the Ames City Council. She is the secretary of the NAACP chapter in Ames, and congratulations to her. She will succeed David Martin, who did not run for re-election. It is 15 after the hour, wherever you are listening to us, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and we are here every week at this time, every week, to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Well, Governor Reynolds signed Iowa's new congressional and legislative boundaries into law last week, and it messes a lot of people up. It puts them in common districts. It changes districts. You and I have talked about this for so long, and we will again. But State House Speaker Pat Grassley announced he would seek re-election to a ninth term, but not in the district he's been in. Let's talk about that.
Yes. Well, I want to say just one more quick thing about the election, because West Liberty, which is a small town in Muscatine County, elected a Latino majority on the city council. This is a town that has, it was the first Iowa town to have a majority Latino population as of the 2010 census, and it now has a Latino majority, 3 out of 5 members on the city council. So I just wanted to mention that, because that is really groundbreaking for the state of Iowa as well. But yes, these new maps, we're hearing almost every day, I hear new candidate announcements of what's going to be happening and where people are going. And Pat Grassley, he's not going far. His district didn't change too much. It still includes Butler County, which is where the Grassley family, it's been their base for a long time. It includes a little bit of Bremer County, but it is a different number. But this is a better map for him than the first map, where he was paired up with a fellow House Republican. This one, he doesn't have to worry about shuffling anything around. There were other incumbent pairings, but not affecting the Speaker, Pat Grassley, this time on the map that they approved.
You've been reporting on some other change-ups here, and we can get into that, I think, probably in the ensuing weeks. But yes, Tonight, let's talk about, since we're still loaded here, Governor Reynolds setting a special election for the state Senate's first district seat being vacated by Republican Zach Whiting of Spirit Lake. So let's download that one.
So this is one of the most, this is the second most Republican Iowa Senate district in the state. It's way up in northwest Iowa. It includes several counties. And Zach Whiting is a first term member of the Senate. He previously was a staffer for Steve King, member of Congress, and he won the seat. You may recall that there was a longtime state senator, David Johnson, a Republican, who left the Republican Party in 2016 to protest Donald Trump becoming the presidential nominee. And he was an independent. He had been elected 4 times as a Republican up there. But as an independent, of course, the Republicans were ready to mount a strong campaign to defeat him. And David Johnson ended up not seeking re-election in 2018. So Zach Whiting won a 3-way Republican primary, and then the general election just wasn't even really a contest. This is not a district that Democrats have any chance at. So he is taking a job in Texas for a right-wing think tank, and so that leaves an open seat up there. It's, again, it's not really a question. It's not like the special election we were discussing in Ankeny in September, which was really close, and a lot of money was spent, and there was a lot of suspense in what's going to happen. This one, the only suspense is going to be who comes out of the Republican district nominating convention, because the special election is going to be held in December. But there's really no question that whoever becomes the Republican nominee is going to take up that Senate seat. So that is going to maintain the current Republican majority in the Iowa Senate, which is 32-18.
And we have sad news to report on this broadcast. Reported last week, the death of former Iowa Congressman Neil Smith, a Polk County Democrat. Neil Smith, for those who don't know, and we're about to talk about him, and Laura will explain this, is an absolute legend in Iowa politics, a giant. And let's talk about who this man is and was.
Neil Smith is the longest serving Iowan to ever serve in the U.S. House. He was there for 36 years. He rose to the 3rd ranking position on the Appropriations Committee, And he brought, it would be hard to overstate how much, how many projects and how much funding he brought to the state of Iowa, particularly Central Iowa, including Iowa State University, really owes a lot to Neil Smith. He had attended a Drake University Law School, but he was very supportive of Iowa State. And he, there were a lot of projects. One of the most famous parts of his legacy is the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge in Prairie City, which is the largest tall grass prairie restoration in the world. But there are just, so it's almost too much to mention. But Smith, I learned some new things about Smith just last week reading people's reflections after he passed away. And he was 101 years old, we should add. I was disappointed. There was supposed to be at Drake a 100th birthday celebration for Neil Smith in March of 2020, and it was canceled because of the coronavirus. If it had just been a week earlier, they might have gotten away with holding that, but that would have been a fantastic event. But he, in the 1960s, this was interesting, Senator Tom Harkin mentioned this in a commentary he wrote for the Des Moines Register, that Neil Smith, even though he was a Democrat, he was bothered by the fact that President John F. Kennedy appointed his brother as Attorney General, and he thought that shouldn't happen, and he introduced an anti-nepotism bill. And a few years later, he got that bill passed and signed into law. So he wasn't super popular with a Kennedy White House for those efforts. But he was a principled person and not just a party guy. And the other one thing that I want to say about Neil Smith, this is a record that probably won't be broken. He has had three former staffers who were elected to Congress themselves. Burt Banstra won in 1964. Ed Mazvinsky was elected in 1972. And Tom Harkin himself, who of course represented the district, including Story County and Ames during the 1970s, he was elected in 1974.
Just in, by coincidence, several months ago, I was listening to an old NBC Radio Network newscast on a program called Monitor, and it was the top of the hour, and they interviewed a congressman from Iowa about a topic, and I can't remember which one it was. And this was in 1966. The congressman was Neil Smith of Iowa, and he had been elected in 1959. He served until 1995. And he was on that newscast, and he just had, as you said, can't underestimate the impact he had on this state.
And I didn't know him well, but I saw him. He was in good health. He would drive himself to Polk County Democratic events or Third District Democratic events well into his 90s. The last time I saw him at an event, I want to say it was in 2018. And the last time I spoke with him on the phone was in 2019. I was working on a story about the first passage of the Hyde Amendment, which is the ban on federal funding for abortion through Medicaid. That happened in 1976. So I tried to interview all of the living former members of Congress from Iowa. And Neil Smith was 99 years old at the time. And he had recall, incredible detail of that vote. He remembered Congressman Hyde, the Republican, standing there trying to lobby people as they were walking into the chamber and then looking at him and saying, oh, never mind, you go on. I know I've lost your vote anyway. So he, you know, just an incredible wealth of information that he had. And he participated in so many important things, and he mentored so many people, and really just that he lost in that 1994 a landslide election. And part of the reason was because his district in the redistricting in the 1990s no longer included Story County. If it had included Story County and Iowa State University, who knows how long he would have served, because he really didn't lose that election by much. And as I mentioned, Iowa State just owed a lot to Neil Smith's position on the Appropriations Committee.
A man who will not be forgotten by anybody who knows politics in this country. One more note here. We have about 5 minutes left. I wish we had better news about the coronavirus on this Monday as we go live, but we do not. The number of coronavirus cases in Iowa continuing its upward trend again. Today, Monday, the State Health Department reported 7,900 new positive tests in the previous 7 days. It has gone up every reporting period for the last several weeks. That's more than 1,000 new cases a day. Hospitalizations are also on the rise. Positivity rate going up. Laura, it appears as if we're going back in to a very bad period again.
Yes. And I mean, with this level of vaccination, it's surprising. The hospitalizations are not quite as high as they were a month ago, but they're still very high. I mean, they're higher than they were for most of the pandemic. We're at levels that we saw in late October of 2020, and we really shouldn't be there with this amount of people able to be vaccinated, and we're still losing dozens of people a week. So I'm hopeful. I think that the boosters going out, that may help. The fact that the 5 to 11-year-olds are able to get vaccinated, that may help somewhat, but we've still just got quite a lot. I mean, just in the last 24 hours, 70 patients admitted to hospital with COVID-19. I mean, that is a pretty high rate of hospital admissions still. And it is worrying as we go into these colder months when people spend a lot of time indoors. It's just, you wonder, I mean, we're already past 7,000 deaths and we're having dozens more Iowans die every week.
There was new reporting over the weekend in the major national newspapers that, again, this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. 40% of Republican voters are not vaccinated compared to 10% of Democratic voters. It's also a party pandemic now.
Yes, and unfortunately, the deaths are also diverging. So in 2020, when people were calculating the per capita death rate in red counties and blue counties, it was fairly even. But in 2021, ever since the vaccine has been widely available, every month that they've tracked these numbers, the per capita death rate in red counties, counties that voted for Trump in the last presidential election, has gone up, has continued to go up. And the disparity between the Trump counties and the Biden counties has increased. And it's really attributable to that vaccination rate. So it's worrying. But again, you know, I don't know. We're not seeing a lot of increased vaccinations. I mean, I'm hopeful that a lot of children, more children clearly will be able to get the vaccine now. But I check periodically the vaccination rates by county in Iowa, and we still have the counties where Republicans tend to get more than 70% of the vote are the counties with the lowest vaccination rate. So it's really strongly correlated. And I know correlation is not always causation, but there is clearly a very strong correlation here.
And now it's going to be interesting to see if those who are not vaccinated are going to allow their children to be vaccinated with the new vaccines.
Well, I think that's fairly unlikely. People who are not vaccinated themselves are probably not going to sign their children up, especially if it's not mandatory, and it's clearly not going to be mandatory for children for some time. So I've seen several people, healthcare workers, talk about how the hospital population is younger than it used to be, that they used to get more elderly people, and now because the vaccination rate among the elderly is so much higher, they're really seeing more people even in their 20s, 30s, and 40s being hospitalized with severe complications for COVID-19. And it's almost certainly, if those people had been vaccinated, their cases would have been more mild.
Just a couple of minutes left. So very quickly, the Biden administration announced that vaccine rules applying to private businesses with 100 or more workers are going to take effect January 4th. That has been temporarily halted by a federal appeals court. Governor Reynolds has signed on to lawsuits that would block that.
Yes. So she's part of a lawsuit that's mostly Republican controlled states trying to block this mandate. And we'll see where it goes. As you said, the federal judge has already put a hold on this order. And I don't know whether the fact that it was an order issued by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, rather than a law passed by Congress, that might give it slightly less weight in court compared to something that had been passed into law. So not clear what's happening. The state of Iowa's government, the Department of Administrative Services, which is like the human resources agency for state government, their director sent out an email last Thursday saying, don't change anything, don't do anything related to this mandate because Iowa's going to be part of litigation challenging this. So far, not a lot is changing. I believe the rule was scheduled to go into effect in early January. So I don't know whether any of this federal litigation might be resolved before January. I would guess probably not.
Wow. Let's take a deep breath. We have 30 seconds left. What in the world do you expect for this week? Is it going to be as hectic as the last week was?
Yes. Well, I'm still catching up on some news related to some of the local elections, but every day we have new announcements of state legislators about where they're moving or possibly retiring some of the ones who were paired up with other incumbents. So I'm keeping track of that very closely. But I think we're now entering, as we get closer to the holidays, there's usually a little bit of a lull with a little bit less state government news.
But there'll be no lull with us because you and I are going to be right back here next week at this same time. At least I will be, and I want you to promise me you're going to be here too.
Absolutely. Same time, same channel.
Same station. Exactly right. Hey, Laura, you have a great week. That is it. We are out of time. You have been listening, and we are grateful for that, to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI Radio or its staff. Laura Bellin and I will zoom right back here in this time slot next week with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We know you have other things to do. We're grateful you spent your time with us. We value it very much. Between now and next time, we hope you have a great week.